You're listening to the New Security Broadcast from the Wilson Center's Environmental Change and Security Program. I'm Lauren Reese. Today, in partnership with the Environmental Peacebuilding Association, we're launching a series of oral history interviews with thought leaders and frontline workers in environmental peacebuilding. From the experts who helped shape the field from its earliest days to those working to put it into practice today, our guests give us a behind-the-scenes look at how the field first emerged and how it's being shaped by new approaches and new voices. In this first episode, ECSP's Claire Doyle speaks with Dr. Ken Konka and Dr. Jeff DeBelko. Ken and Jeff were pioneers in environmental peacebuilding, helping to define and elevate the relevance of the field since its earliest days. Ken is a professor of global environmental governance at the School of International Service at American University, and is a director on the board of the Environmental Peacebuilding Association. He most recently co-edited the Oxford Handbook of Water Politics and Policy with Dr. Erica Weinthal. Jeff DeBelko is a professor of environmental studies at Ohio University and a senior advisor for ECSP, where he was director from 1997 to 2012. Last year, Jeff was an author on the 5th National Climate Assessments International Chapter. Ken and Jeff have a long history of collaborating. They co-edited the 2002 book, Environmental Peacemaking, one of the foundational books in the field of environmental peacebuilding. They also co-edited the widely used teaching anthology, Green Planet Blues. And in 2018, they jointly received the Al-Mumin Award for Thought Leadership in Environmental Peacebuilding.
Ken and Jeff, thank you so much for joining us on this podcast. It's really wonderful to have you here with us. You were both key actors in the early days of the field of environmental peacebuilding. So I want to start by looking back at the contributions you made that helped shape the field as it was becoming established. You co-edited the 2002 book, Environmental Peacemaking. And when you wrote this book, there was some scholarship connecting environment and security, but mostly focused on the conflict risks posed by environmental issues with a kind of a scarcity lens. So I'd love to start by hearing what initially brought each of you to the intersection of environment and peace at this time, and what drove you to write the book together. And Jeff, maybe we can start with you.
Sure. Thank you so much, Claire. In the mid-90s, the focus in the environment security space was most heavily on this question of, does a scarcity of resources and environment, does that drive conflict? Does that contribute to conflict? And that was an interesting set of questions, but ended up being, by the mid-90s, a fairly limited set of questions, limited because it's not necessarily a large number of cases, and because the data, the information, the understanding made it difficult to use some of the methods that folks wanted to use to study these questions. And so it was a source of kind of frustration, both on the research side where Ken and I were directly collaborating. And then I was also wearing the hat at the Woodrow Wilson Center's Environmental Change and Security Program, where we were trying to facilitate dialogue between scholars like Ken and practitioners, and to deepen understanding, but also to try to change practice, right, to address these links. And so that was the kind of origin for the interest in flipping it on its head and saying, can this set of issues where we have long-term interdependencies around resources and communities, countries, regions, can that be actually a source for building trust and ultimately and ambitiously peace? And so Ken was really kind of, and I'll pass it to him, was really kind of driving this from a theoretical and still deductive, but theoretical perspective that, hey, we really need to step back and think about this differently.
Similar experience and context. I am a little older than Jeff. And so I think Jeff is describing the early post-Cold War intellectual and policy context that we found ourselves in. I would take it back earlier to that. I remember sitting as an undergraduate, a geology major, sitting in an international relations course in 1981, 1982, and the professor was a really prominent liberal internationalist. And the best vision for the future that he could offer us at the end of the course was that if the United States and the Soviet Union succeeded in not blowing each other up, maybe with the evolution of time 30, 40 years down the road, they could converge on a form of democratic socialism or social democracy, something that looked vaguely like Sweden. You know, and 8 years later, the Cold War was over. And the field that I was learning, international relations, because I kept getting drawn into interest in those questions, had no explanation for it. So in the early post-Cold War period, there was this really interesting intellectual fermentation of looking around for, you know, new sources of conflict and new characteristics of the international system. And Jeff and I were both really interested in these sort of, you know, post-Westphalian, post-sovereign globalization kinds of narratives that were just starting to emerge. And the environment emerged as a really interesting focal point in that. But I think we were very dissatisfied with the framework, the lens through which the environment was being seen. Basically, natural resource scarcities and environmental impacts lead to grievances, and grievances lead to conflict. And that seemed to be both a kind of an incomplete narrative. There was a lot more going on around environment and questions of justice and power and so on than simply scarcity. And it also seemed pretty dismal. Why couldn't it lead to more sort of positive pathways? So I think what really started us off, and the reason we started working on the project that became the book, Environmental Peacemaking, was really just trying to stand that narrative on its head. The first chapter in that book is called The Case for Environmental Peacemaking. And we really felt that an intellectual case had to be made. It may not be necessary today, but at the time it really was, that there were peaceful pathways out of our socio-ecological interdependencies. So trying to conceptualize that, trying to document it with some case studies in the early post-Cold War period, when things were still sort of pretty fluid, became the intellectual purpose that eventually led to that book.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that first chapter, The Case for Environmental Peacemaking. It is kind of emblematic of where things stood then, and then also, as you mentioned, how far we've come. Do you remember the early discussions that led up to the book being formulated?
Sure. So Jeff won't say it because he's modest, but his role as the director of the Environmental Change and Security Program at the Woodrow Wilson Center was absolutely critical in this period. It became a space where people who were interested in these questions could gather and debate and dialogue. And we had a series of workshops. We had no funding or anything like that. We had a series of workshops. And a lot of people would come through Washington for one reason or another. And so we started to meet some fellow travelers, right? Some other junior scholars who were interested in similar sorts of questions. And that was really the genesis for the book. The other key driver, though, was global symmetry, right? I mean, we were really kind of intellectually baked in the Earth Summit era, right? Rio 1992, the UNCED meeting, which was really the high watermark still to this day in some ways for international environmental cooperation. And as it became clear that there was going to be a Rio plus 10 in Johannesburg, the bloom was sort of off the rose of UNCED at that point. It was becoming apparent that this sustainability narrative by itself was not going to galvanize the kind of global cooperation that was really needed to address these very serious challenges. And so people were casting around for other alternative frameworks. And we watched with some dismay as the security narrative started to emerge. And there were some actors that really wanted to make the Johannesburg summit be an environmental security summit. And again, we found that problematic for a lot of reasons. And so the real idea behind the book was that if we could put something together that offered an alternative narrative, a narrative centered around peace rather than simply around violence and conflict and insecurity, that, you know, in our youthful hubris, we thought that maybe we could influence the narrative. Now, of course, being scholars, we didn't get the book out until after the Johannesburg meeting was finished, and it didn't have the impact at that moment that we had hoped. But that was really the driver. And I think that says something about the field as a whole, because, of course, we are not, you know, the creators of the field or anything like that. We were just a pair of voices at the time. I think it says that from the start, there was a really strong desire by people gravitating to this area to engage policy and to do work that was policy.
Claire, I'd add that I think it was interesting that in that same way that like-minded scholars who were asking some of the same questions came together. And while we didn't set out to do it, we ended up doing a book about water. Environmental Peacemaking is a book about looking at the interdependencies and the ways that water can be managed at different levels, although we had a lot of focus on the international regional level, in ways that we could see evidence of that need for the necessity of long-term cooperation being an avenue towards trying to build trust in a variety of uncertain contexts. And so I think it did a number of things. One, it showed us that there were interesting areas to look along a continuum from prevention to peacemaking and ending conflict and being a kind of a lifeline for dialogue and when things are bad between parties, and then in a post-conflict setting and building back in conflict-affected context. And so in that way, it really did hone in, although it wasn't our original intention, on a particular resource, which then raised all sorts of questions about, okay, are these dynamics more likely or are playing out in one way for water and others for forest and others for fish? And so land that then opened up a whole agenda for research and practice and the kind of interface between what we're seeing going on in the field, so to speak, and what the research agenda was.
I think that's a perfect segue because I also wanted to ask about this interface between practice and research. This is something that you touch on in an article in International Affairs called Past and Futures of Environmental Peacebuilding, which you both contributed to. In that article, you write with your co-authors that, quote, the growth and evolution of knowledge on environmental peacebuilding has been based on and driven by practice and policy action as much as it has been advanced by theory and scholarly research. So this is a thread that you've already kind of touched on, but I'm curious, can you tell us what this interplay between academic research, practice, and policy has looked like in a little bit more detail? And how has it shaped the field? And I'll start with you, Jeff, on this one.
Yeah, well, Ken alluded to the role that we were trying to play at the Wilson Center's Environmental Change and Security Program. And that really was a forum, as the Wilson Center is set up, as a place for those in practice and those in research to come together. And so in some ways, we had the challenge of almost who goes first or chicken and egg, right? So the practitioners said, okay, I'll grant your deductive argument. What works? Tell me what to do. Tell me what not to do. And those on the research side, try it and we'll study it and we'll tell you, right? And so it was a little bit of that kind of who goes first and what's required to kind of progress our understanding from field-based and from research. I do think that, and maybe not surprising in that sense, that the practitioners who wanted to try to be innovative work across different areas of environment, later climate, natural resource management, and peace and conflict. And it wasn't everybody who wanted to get out of their silos and do that. But those willing to try that in the field were then experimenting. And those of us often kind of in close collaboration so that the scholars could be in on the takeoffs as well, so we could study the landings, that through groups like the Geneva-based offices of the UN Environment Program, which changed names a lot of times, but had this kind of focus on environment, particularly post-conflict in settings, is one example. Some of the bilateral aid agencies that were experimenting with some of this. And so in that way, I think positively, some of the practitioners were certainly asking tough questions about what works, and then some of them trying to do it, and us kind of from that research side, trying to then study and see patterns and point to productive directions and guard against ways that it may not be as productive.
Yeah, an example of that, I think, is the UN Environment Program. So as Jeff noted, we published the book, and the response that we got, one of the responses that we got was, well, this is nice theorizing, but can you prove that it really works? And I think we looked at each other and we scratched our heads. And I think our first response was to say, well, if you'll try it, we'll be happy to study it and, you know, monitor and evaluate it using the jargon of today. But that was an unsatisfying response. And so I began casting around looking for places where there might actually be a body of evidence, case histories, empirics, just something that you could use to advance the field. And I discovered the post-conflict studies, basically post-conflict environmental impact assessments, that a small branch of the UN Environment Program based in Geneva had started doing, particularly in the wake of the Balkan Wars, when there was a lot of fear about the toxification of the NATO bombing of Serbia and so on. And so the UN Environment Program was drafted to send a team in and try to assess what was going on. And out of that came a very sort of weakly institutionalized process of studying countries that were emerging from conflict. And those countries started lining up, asking for those studies. There was a lot of demand for this from war-torn societies. And so I went to Geneva and I sat with the group, and they were very generous about opening their archives, sitting for interviews, the people that had been out doing the fieldwork and so on. And out of that came an article that I published with one of my doctoral students at the time, Jennifer Wallace, in Global Governance, 2008, 2009, something like that. That was really a sort of a first attempt to distill some patterns from, you know, a dozen or so reasonably well-documented cases that, that they had put together. That experience led UNEP to think that there was value in having a relationship with scholarship in this space. And I think the main driving force was that UNEP was a small, weak agency that struggled in the context of the larger UN system to engage more influential groups like the UN Development Program, or at the time, what was called the Department of Peacekeeping Operations. And so I think UNEP was seeking a certain kind of intellectual legitimacy for the policy advocacy work they were doing, which basically said, these issues are critically important in post-conflict settings, and you've got to get environmental protection and natural resource governance right, or you're going to trigger new forms of conflict or slide back into the old forms of conflict. And so out of that came an expert advisory group that Jeff and I both participated, along with some other folks who were present from the earliest days of this work, people like Erica Weinthal, Richard Matthew, several others, and also several practitioners. Silas Theacor was there, Global Witness was involved. And that was a very interesting group that from the start was kind of doing hybrid scholarly work and policy work, trying to provide some intellectual evidence for the policy agenda, but also willing to let the policy agenda be steered a little bit by what the evidence was telling it.
I add just one kind of interesting detail then in terms of the back and forth between the practitioners and the scholars, and particularly through the UN. And so while we talked about the ways that environmental peace building had prospects in a prevention and during conflict and after conflict, the politics and the institutional structures at the UN really only, especially initially, only provided space to look in post-conflict. Member states really wanted to avoid an avenue that might lead to any sort of rationale for intervention or telling them what they could or couldn't do as sovereign states around natural resources for a prevention mission. And so when the switch came from the practitioner saying, prove to me that there's a connection, to, okay, I buy the argument, even if it's deductive, tell me what to do, then it was politically safe, and where folks within the UN and UN Environment Program could operate, there's focus on the Peacebuilding Commission and the post-conflict, because states were open to that, and there was much less willing during conflict and prior to conflict. And so I think in some ways that gets to why environmental peacebuilding really became the go-to title for the umbrella of these various kind of strands of research.
Yeah, the whole UN system has a peacebuilding mandate. UNEP does not have an operational mandate in country. You know, it's not like UNDP, which has missions on the ground and so on. UNEP goes where it's invited. And so the combination of the fact that it didn't have an operational mandate and that it didn't have a conflict prevention or conflict management mandate. I mean, that's the Secretary General, that's the Security Council. So there were always countries, and understandably so, countries that, you know, had to fight for their sovereignty, fight for their freedom. And, you know, colonial control of natural resources was a big piece of what they were fighting against. They were always wary of UNEP, you know, getting outside of its lane on those sorts of issues. And so one of the reasons why there's been so much emphasis on the post-conflict dimension, there's great need there, of course, but also it was a space that this activity could grow into when some other equally important spaces, let's say, you know, mediation in situations of environmental tension, Ethiopia and Egypt around the Nile, I mean, many other examples, that space simply wasn't available. It was too geopolitically sensitive for these, you know, relatively small and weak entities within the UN to enter into. And so that's one of the reasons why the field has grown unevenly across the broader landscape of the challenges.
Yeah, it's interesting to hear how some of the historical context or what was happening at the time informed the field and the direction that it took. So I think a bit earlier on, you mentioned a couple summits that were influential in writing the environmental peacemaking book, the Earth Summit in Rio, and then the Johannesburg Summit that you wanted to offer an alternative narrative for. So on that note, what were some of the other maybe key conferences or books or pieces of scholarship that you think encapsulate the early days of the field?
It's hard to explain how different of a setting that it was. I attended a workshop recently that was funded by a foundation that was interested in growing into this space. And they had gathered together several people who've done a lot of work in this space. And they asked me and several others to, you know, make a few preliminary remarks. And my first remark was to say that it was just really wonderful to be sitting in a room with that many people who cared about this, because at the time that we were getting started, it's not that there weren't lots of people out there and well before us trying to do work, but we didn't have a name for it. We didn't have a coherent conceptual framework for the various bits that people were working on. And from where we were coming, which was a sort of a broken field of international relations that had failed to see the Cold War coming and was trying to stitch itself together around some very new conceptions of the global system, the number of people who took this very seriously, you know, you could have fit them in the back corner of that room and they could have had a nice quiet conversation back there. The reason we did a book was that it really wasn't possible to get this into the scholarly journals of the time. It wasn't part of the agenda. There wasn't interest. It was often dismissed, as the book in some quarters was initially dismissed, as this is just a sort of a naive functionalism. You know, this is the dream that birthed the UN, that if you got countries cooperating initially on things that don't matter much, like coordinating air traffic control or postal service or something, eventually they'll build habits of cooperation that lead them to share nuclear weapons or something like that. And that is, of course, wrong to think that that would happen. But that wasn't what we were arguing. We were arguing that these issues had a new salience, that they were high politics, that they mattered enough to governments, that it might be possible to draw governments into more healthy and cooperative relationships around them. But initially, edited volumes were very important and books were very important because it was almost the only space where you could start to make that case. So that was one important difference. A second important difference is that I think it really was the transnational dynamic of this, the larger scale conflicts. I mean, Jeff mentioned that a lot of our book ended up being about water, unintentionally, but not surprisingly, maybe. And it was really shared international river basins that drove the narrative. You know, people weren't talking about this on the scale of a single watershed. They were, but not in this language. And it was really more the broader transnational sorts of dimensions. And one of the things I think we've seen as the field has evolved is that people are working at a range of different scales, and they're also trying to connect those scales. That's a real challenge for the field, because it's not clear that some of our core concepts, like, let's say, building trust, for example, or cooperative knowledge, undertakings. It's not clear that that works the same between governments as it does between people that live, you know, upstream and downstream on a body of water or on opposite banks of a river and so on. But we've really seen that sort of growth and that sort of evolution. And of course, the other thing is climate change. I don't know if we're going to get into climate change and how that's changed the field and so on, but climate change is now the 500-pound gorilla in the room in terms of a lot of this activity.
I would add to Ken's point about his experience saying it's great to see some folks interested in this topic and more people at the table. And I think that definitely has become the case. I think in those early days, it's absolutely correct to say it was hard to find space to publish. And so the literature was scattered across all sorts of journals and outlets. I would also be slightly less polite than Kenton was about those willing to engage. And in some ways, it's understandable, but I can't say enough about then and now how reified our silos are for what topics are funded in a given track by a foundation, by a government agency, by an NGO, humanitarian organization, environment. The challenge of trying to put at least two different worlds together of environment, natural resources, now climate, with foreign policy, let alone security policy and humanitarian response. There are just so many players who have their playbook, have their focus, have their funding stream, that asking them to have multiple bottom lines, multiple wins, and then multiple indicators of how you achieve it. Understandably difficult, right? In some cases where success is something not happening, and in other cases it needs to be tangible and countable to work in the frameworks of the funding. But I think that kind of broadly described as working across disciplines, across sectors, is easy to say, much harder to do. And it really took those willing to kind of break out of those silos to do it.
Right, right. I want to go back to the note about climate change that Ken made and dwell on this actually for a moment. Ken, you alluded to how climate change has impacted the space of environmental peacebuilding. And Jeff, I think this is something that you spoke about a little bit in your remarks following the Al Mumin Award, talking about climate change being initially seen as a long-term kind of diffuse topic in the field of environmental peacebuilding, but that since 2007 or so, it's actually been a key entry point for conversations in this field. So starting with you, Jeff, can you tell us about this shift towards focusing more on the links between climate and security and what it's meant for the field of environmental peacebuilding?
Sure. Climate change starting in 2007 became the point of entry, as Ken says, this kind of 500-pound gorilla that in some ways kind of blocks out a lot of other topics that are connected. And I think we are seeing progress as folks are trying to bring climate change down into specific contexts and what it means within different natural resource and environmental areas. Then there is a kind of the opportunity for convergence. But 2007 was significant because it was the first time that the Security Council looked at any environmental issue, and they looked at climate issue at the behest of the Brits. It was the publication date for the CNA report that brought together retired military officers in the U.S., not to pass judgment on whether climate change was happening, but to look through their very traditional security lens and say, is this going to have impacts on the things that is our day job, the traditional security? And their answer was a resounding yes, and a message not to the military per se, but to those working the climate change issue, that there was this additional imperative, because if it ended up on their desks, as General Zinni would say, it's a very blunt and expensive instrument in terms of problem solving. Dealing with it in other ways would be far preferable. And so I think in some ways it did block out the sun, and literally, figuratively. So the challenge of maintaining an active environmental peacebuilding agenda was there. I do think that climate security links have many different dimensions, and the kind of focus as a tactic of having the security community deliver, I mean, this was the problem with those early years, the same ask at, say, Copenhagen. And so those who would be skeptical would say, I was born at night, but not last night. You're asking for the same UNFCCC climate convention set of tools and not really bringing that down to what it means to issues of peace and conflict. I do think now the really interesting work that's happening is as we're making investments in adaptation, poverty alleviation, and peace building and the kind of peace and conflict issues, are there ways that those can be done well so that there are triple bottom line and three wins? And then this kind of other notion that we've raised in the last, say, 10 years, how do we make sure as we do well-intentioned climate responses, we're not also locking in some of those inequalities and contributing to ongoing or creating new conflicts, and doing that in a way so that it is not a climate spurring these kind of backdraft dynamics, as we called them, or more recently, kind of ensuring a just and peaceful transition as we address the climate challenges.
Yeah, I would say that when people ask me to say, what is environmental peace building? It's actually an umbrella that has several different kinds of goals and initiatives and agendas underneath it, right? One of them is the one that Jeff and I were trying to push with the book and a lot of the early days work that we dubbed environmental peacemaking. The idea of really using the environment, using socio-ecological interdependencies instrumentally to try to promote peace, to engage actors in situations of tension or outright conflict and try to build trust, create cooperative knowledge, draw them into longer term kinds of arrangements, possibly even softening hardened conflict identities in the process. You look at an organization like EcoPeace, and climate change is there, right? Because EcoPeace is basically saying to the parties in the Jordan River Valley, we're all here. Our fates are intertwined. The region is getting smacked by climate change, and we have to find ways to cooperate and coexist and collaborate and adapt to the situation that we're facing. And so climate change has become very central to the agenda that Jeff and I were pushing, because climate adaptation creates enormous opportunities, demands really for various forms of collaboration and cooperation at all scales. A second strand of the field is the tensions and the conflict around natural resources and the environment. And this is basically the consequences of extractivism, right? And there's a large literature about the role of natural resource extraction in fomenting violence and civil war, either as a set of grievances or as a funding mechanism. You know, as resources are being plundered, it allows combat to be sustained and so on and so forth. And climate change can trigger a new form of extractivism, right? We look at rare earth metals and we look at the quest for the sort of the new global political economy of energy sustainability. There's a lot of embedded tensions in that that are going to have to be managed and transformed, really. And climate change is driving that part of our field forward. And the final piece of it is the idea that the environment itself, environmental protection and environmental agendas can drive conflict. Not all environmental cooperation is equivalent in its ethics and in its implications for violence. One of the points we tried to make in the book, those 20-something years ago, 25 years ago when we started the project, was that environmental cooperation could end up being nothing more than joint resource plunder, and that's hardly peacemaking. And when we look at the adaptation agenda around climate change, you know, there's no question that if the solution is going to be the construction of large dams because big hydro is an allegedly sustainable fuel, there's all sorts of potential for violence. So in a way, climate change is really nothing more than a very loud signal across all three of those strands of what I take to be the coalition of environmental peace building. It's sometimes frustrating because, of course, as Jeff said, policy agendas always have funding streams and deliverables and standard operating procedures attached. And as someone who works on water issues primarily, it's a sort of a bipolar experience, because if you can connect your water concerns to climate change, now you have the ear of policymakers. Now you have the possibility of funding. Now it's possible to write grants to do research and all of that. And if you cannot connect your agenda to climate change, it sometimes almost feels like climate change has sucked all of the air out of the room for the various other kinds of concerns. There's an enormous environmental peace building agenda around land use, around toxification, around coastal zone resource management, and sometimes making sure that that part of the field sustains and thrives and is on the radar in a world that's flailing for climate solutions has become a challenge. And so it's been interesting to see climate change shift from being a sort of a back burner concern for us, because we were interested in the more immediate ways that people were connected to environmental change or to resource extraction or to tensions, to see it come to really dominate the agenda in many ways. It's very important, but in some ways it's a mixed blessing.
Yeah, those are, I think, great words of caution that you both touched on in terms of not letting the kind of climate conversation eclipse other elements of environmental peace building, but also something you both spoke about in terms of environmental agendas potentially contributing to new conflicts or new forms of tension. So maybe starting with you, Ken, now, beyond this shift towards climate, how else have you seen the field of environmental peace building evolve over the last 3 decades or so? How would you kind of describe the evolution that you've seen?
One of the most important things that's happened is the creation of the Environmental Peacebuilding Association. And that's important because it really doubles down on Jeff's essential earlier point about bringing a broad and diverse array of voices into the space. Gender is, it's really interesting to trace the history of the way that gender intersects with concerns about the relationship between environment on the one hand and peace and conflict on the other hand. In the early days of this field, half of humanity was missing from the conversation, both as agents in the activities that people were trying to characterize and capture and program around and so on, and also as voices in the policy community, in the practitioner community, the activist community, and the scholarly community. It's not that they were not there, but it was just very difficult for those voices to punch through. There's still an enormous amount of work to be done on that, but there's been a lot of positive possibilities. To see an organization like NPACS with, you know, I'm going to guess that half of the membership of NPACS, if not more, is people who are in the space of practice, practitioners, right? Whether they're attached to civil society organizations or advocacy groups or government agencies or intergovernmental organizations, that's critically important. And also to see the intellectual heterogeneity, people from political ecology, people from human geography, people from international relations, people from every sort of space in between. The building out of those kinds of networks, it's been slow, it's been imperfect. There are still a lot of power dynamics at work in the field that make it easier for some people to get space and attention than others. And we need to be, you know, rigorously attentive to that going forward. But when you compare it to 25 years ago, it's quite extraordinary. And the other thing I'll flag just briefly is to say that as a teacher, it's extraordinarily different. I won't say that I taught the first course in North America on environmental peace building when I was a graduate student instructor at Berkeley in 1990. I'd run out of funding and I needed one more year of funding for my health insurance mostly. So I went over to the peace studies department and pitched this idea for a course, and they really liked it. And a lot of the early teaching on this, I will say, was in peace studies programs, not in environmental programs, which were much more wrapped up in the historic conflict narrative, if they looked at these issues at all, than in this idea about peace building and about peacemaking. But at the time, it was really challenging to find reading materials. It was really challenging to find well-documented case studies. You know, the teaching of this was kind of aspirational, I'll say, in a lot of ways. And today, and again, I give NPACS some credit for this, just in one of the functions that it plays is just really helping people pool materials and share materials. There's just a real cornucopia for somebody like me that's trying to teach on these issues compared to what was available previously. And that's critically important because, of course, this agenda is always going to be powered by younger people bringing new ideas and bringing their dissatisfaction with what older people have failed to achieve into the space. And so it's critically important that we attend to the teaching component of this as well.
Yeah, I second Ken's highlighting the creation of the Environmental Peace Building Association, and Carl Brook at ELI has really brought together some of those early folks and achieved critical mass and really made the argument and did the hard work to create that forum. I think it has done what Ken said and even more. So for example, 25 years ago, this was largely, at least where it did get attention, largely a North American and European dialogue. And now there are people from over 50 countries in the association working in research, practice, and policy, and they're at all stages of their careers. Again, not that they weren't working on these issues, but there is a place for them to come together, collaborate, learn from each other, share insights. And what I think that does is it rapidly expands the number of cases, the geography of cases, so places that were less commonly focused on because of access and just not part of the networks that we were initially. That is starting to be addressed. I won't pretend that it is kind of fundamentally addressed, but the Environmental Peacebuilding Association provides that forum. The more recent creation of the Environment Security Journal through the efforts of the association with the support of the association now does provide a place where one knows that you can go to that outlet for submitting your work and reading what others are doing. And that is what's kind of inspirational about the past decade or two, but particularly the last decade, is that next generation of scholars and practitioners coming in and saying, okay, there's this argument, but we're going to really take it forward and we're going to take it into some new areas. And Ken flagged gender. I would also add to that list the kind of total miss on the really low levels of violence with the environmental defenders and kind of targeted violence against local leadership as a way to silence voices and stop protest around these issues. That was a big miss for our field. And that is in part being addressed through some of these dialogues, and having that place to come together allows us to achieve critical mass, learn from each other, be able to start providing some more answers when the practitioners kind of come and say, okay, so let's talk about how to innovate. Let's talk about what may work and what should be avoided. And then issues like, as Ken enunciated, this potential of environmental efforts or climate efforts to create conflict or factor into them, those can be ones that we can very quickly move from a deductive, well, quickly, I don't know, it's been 10 years and maybe we're getting serious about it now, but move from a deductive argument to actually trying to really operationalize those insights and systematically learn from previous or analogous experiences.
Yeah, actually, that's great in terms of queuing up the last question I have for you both, which is about looking forward. So you've spoken just now about some of the changes that you've seen and also that you anticipate might continue around gender, around backdraft. From your vantage point, what do you think is next for the field of environmental peacebuilding? Ken, maybe we can start with you here.
Sure. I worry that the very growing policy salience of the field, particularly around climate security, as you dubbed it earlier, contains a lot of peril for the field. We can't have our field be reduced to managing the ecological consequences of the insecurities of our current global security order and our current global economic order. We have a global economic and security order that breeds insecurity and breeds climate instability, and that is wedded to an extractivist logic that is fundamentally problematic. And I think there's a lot of potential through the work that environmental peace builders do to seek transformative solutions to those problems. But I don't think all responses are equally transformative. All responses are not created equal. And as there's an increasing salience and an increasing policy agenda, just as we were trying to argue that the socio-ecological interdependencies among parties in conflict could be used as the thin edge of the wedge of a transformative agenda that would build peace. I think we have to look at our field as trying to do that now. It drives me crazy how so much of the quote unquote climate security, semi-intellectual, semi-policy kind of work that's being done takes so much as fixed about the current system. So we're worried about climate-driven migration without going upstream to ask why so many people are being put in motion in so many troubling ways by existing sorts of practices, right? We're worried about the risk of violent conflict without looking at the way that our system of war and our system of war preparation, what is the climate footprint of the world's militaries in terms of breeding the very insecurities that we're then being asked to manage? So I would just end with a plea that people keep that idea of the need for solutions to be system transformative rather than the Band-Aid approach, because I think there's going to be a lot of interest in Band-Aids.
Yeah, I think Ken puts his finger on what I hope will be a continuing thread that, as he says, could be in danger of being lost, which is think differently and question what is the dominant focus, right? So the dominant focus when we started this was, does scarcity of resources lead to violence? And we found that to be interesting and important and totally insufficient to represent the kind of full agenda of what could be done, and also somewhat limited in terms of what the responses could be, right? And certainly wouldn't get at some of this transformative change and underlying big picture issues, structural issues that Ken is alluding to. And so just as we want to go deep with more cases and greater, deeper understanding of them, and ideally ways to systematically compare what's going on across these cases and different slices of environmental peace building, my hope is that in the future, we will continue to have that broader view, that critical eye, that let's not just take as a given the current landscape and look for these innovative ways that kind of have the same approach of, hey, let's turn this relationship on its head and ask about peace and not just about conflict, and do that in ways where environment, natural resources, climate are front and center. But again, back to the origins, also in ways where they may be important, but they're not what is being contested, and provide avenue for dialogue and cooperation. And again, it is a kind of inexact science, but I think there's a lot of space between kind of just a naive idealism that if we'll cooperate, we'll trust each other and be peaceful, and finding ways to work together and navigate challenges and do that in ways that are kind of intellectually interesting and very practically connected in ways that it won't ever be kind of settled, right? And so we'll always have a full agenda to tackle through the environmental peace building lens.
Right. Yeah. Well, I think you're both leaving us with some great guiding insights to hang on to coming out of this conversation. So thank you, Jeff and Ken. It was great to hear from both of you.
Thank you, Claire. Great to be able to reflect and reminisce.
No, it's terrific. Thank you so much. It's good fun to think about this together and share it with others.
You've been listening to the New Security Broadcast from the Wilson Center. Thanks for tuning in. For more information, follow us on Twitter @NewSecurityBeat and visit newsecuritybeat.org.